hanging in the purple sky. Baby's sleeping while its mother sighs. Talking about the rich folks. Rich folks have the same jokes, and they park in basic places. The priest is preaching from a shallow grave. He counts his money, then he paints you safe. Talking to the young folks. Young folks share the same jokes, but they meet in older places. So don't tell me about your success, nor your recipes for my happiness. In bed, I never could digest those illusions you claim to have going. The sun.
That's Detroit's own Sixto Rodriguez with Rich Folks Hoax. It's from his 1970 album, Cold Fact. This is Lead Stories. I'm Nutrice Lead. It is Monday, October the 27th, and indeed, we are going to Detroit today. Why? Because a huge development that is extremely distressing, a massive wave of new foreclosures, is about to hit about 150,000 more Detroiters very soon, and that is on top of foreclosures already in progress. We're joined by Abayomi Azikiwe, correspondent here on the Lead Stories program. He is the editor-in-chief of the Pan-African Newswire. He is a Detroiter himself, and he has been keeping us abreast, chiefly as our correspondent on the bankruptcy, the forced bankruptcy of Detroit. And he's joining us again today in a related story, but we'll start first, Abayomi, with what's happening with these new foreclosures, and thanks for being with us today. By the way, I should mention that you are in an area near Chicago, east of Detroit, and we'll get to that in the course of our discussion, but you are in court today with a whole other case, but it's very much related to what's going on in Detroit, and that is following a case of a person, Reverend Pinckney, Belle Glade is in Palm Beach, who has been fighting the emptying of his city in much the same way that many other African American towns and cities in the state of Michigan are currently under assault and currently placed under emergency management by the governor. Abayomi, great to have you with us as usual today.
Well, thank you so much for inviting me back.
Well, let's start with these foreclosures. This is most distressing news. What is happening in Detroit with regard to these foreclosures?
Well, several years ago, the law was changed that said that you could not owe property taxes more than 2 years in arrears. So what has happened is that in the third year, your property automatically goes into foreclosure. If you do not pay the third year delinquency, then of course you lose title to your property. Now, they have a system where people can set up payment arrangements, but oftentimes they're not able to acknowledge or to adhere to the payment arrangement. So this illustrates the degree of poverty and underdevelopment in the city of Detroit and indeed throughout the entire county of Wayne. These tax foreclosures have been increasing over the last several years, and it is estimated that in 2015, the deadline is March 31st to pay your third year in arrears county as well as city taxes. If you do not pay it, you'll lose title, but it's estimated that 150,000 individual houses, parcels of land, properties will go into foreclosure. So you can see this is a humongous crisis that exists in this area, and it's compounded, or it is compounding, the overall mortgage foreclosure crisis, which is still a problem here in the city of Detroit and in the state of Michigan as well.
Well, this is just to give people a sense of how huge this is and how potentially devastating it is. The number of new foreclosures is the equivalent of 1/5 of Detroit's population. So
yes,
this will have the net
more.
Effect essentially of literally wiping out the remaining, a vast percentage of the remaining population in Detroit.
Yes, and it may be more than 1/5 if you consider that within one individual household, you know, you may have up to 8-10 people living, or perhaps even more, in an individual household. And if the property is foreclosed and you lose title to it, they have an auction process, which is different than the way it used to be. It used to be that you had 6 months after you lost title to redeem your property. If you came up with the money to pay the taxes, you could maintain or retain the title. Now, a lot of those properties are reserved for so-called developers, and they will come in and purchase 100, 200, 300, sometimes 600, 700, 800, or 900 properties at once. So you can see they're encouraging this type of land speculation in the city of Detroit and throughout Wayne County. So we've had scandals in terms of developers who have bought these houses in bundles. They've sold them back. Well, in fact, they've rented them to people in a rent-to-own scheme. A lot of times they're on so-called land contracts. The people go into these deals, they sign contracts, and then they find out that the so-called developers have not paid the taxes, back taxes on the home. They have not addressed the existing liens on the homes. So they may be in the house for a year or more, then they start getting notices that they're going to be foreclosed or that they're going to be evicted, that the property has already been foreclosed, because the titles were never registered with the County of Wayne by the developers. So these are the type of fraudulent schemes that are going on in Detroit and in Wayne County as we speak.
Now, Detroit is almost 85% African American. It is almost the case that 40%, almost 40% of its current population is living at or below the poverty line.
Yes.
We've had one of the complications with these taxes is that the water bills are added to the taxes on a property, so that many of the people looking on paper as owing taxes are actually people who have not been able to pay their water bills. The water bills are now added to the tax obligations, and with interest at about 18% a year, we have a massive escalation in the so-called tax burden on each impoverished homeowner. Now, how is it fair to say then that the city's tax, the taxing department, the treasury, the local treasury office, has found a way essentially to aid and abet the emptying of the city by saying, okay, we will put your water bills, which are under a great deal of protest and contention because people have problems about the ways they had been assessed with their water bills. And those issues had not been those issues have not been tackled and solved. So now we have a city agency literally saying, ah, this is a great time that we can literally speed up the evictions and the foreclosure processes.
Yes. Well, the tax laws are formulated on a state level. And for a number of years now, the ultra-right wing has dominated the state legislature and the governor's office. So consequently, these schemes are designed to do just what you described, and that is to further empty out the city from the African-American inhabitants. So this is a process that's carried out. We've seen cases where people who have had their homes paid for, whose property taxes are very low because the actual value of the property is not that great, and then they can get hardship exemptions as well. But due to the trash fees, there's a trash fee as well that was about $300 a year. I'm not sure exactly what it is now. And also the placing of the delinquent water bills on the property taxes, they have actually gone into tax foreclosure simply because of their inability to pay the trash fee as well as the water bills. Now, the water bills, as you mentioned, many of them have absolutely nothing to do with the actual amount of water that's being used. People have attempted to contest the validity of the water bills, and it takes them like months to even get a hearing. So it's really not a process that is workable. Now, if someone says you have a water shutoff notice, in 2 weeks your water will be shut off, or in 10 days it will be shut off, and you say, well, I don't owe $2,000 or $3,000 in a water bill, I want to have a hearing to contest the validity of the water bill, and they say, well, we'll give you a hearing sometime next year. In the meantime, your water is slated to be shut off. So you have to pay the bill, whether it's legitimate or not. Also, we have to look at the fact that there are tens of thousands of abandoned industrial, commercial, and residential structures in the city of Detroit, that many of whom have been owned by the banks. Some are controlled by Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac. Some are controlled by the city of Detroit and the state of Michigan. What has happened is that these properties have had broken pipes. People may have left the water running, and this water has been running sometimes for months, if not years. Now, this is pure waste. And who pays for that? It's the poor and working people who live in the city of Detroit. Their water bills are a reflection of this type of inefficiency and waste in the water system. And all of this was brought out in federal bankruptcy court in a class action lawsuit that was filed in September. A trial was held last month, and the judge dismissed the lawsuit, saying that he didn't have jurisdiction to stop the water shutoffs, at least providing a mechanism to try to recorrect the system so people can get fair bills and then they can pay those bills. But this is the type of due process, or lack of due process, that is in existence right now.
This year alone, the city would have effected close to 30,000 foreclosures. This is now the ongoing process of emptying the city. We are facing now one-fifth or more, perhaps, of the population, remaining population, being placed in foreclosure in the next couple of months. Has this in any way constituted a major, major, major crisis in the city of Detroit? And what is the reaction of the various political establishments that are there, the political leaders? What is the response to this thing? This is just incredible that it hasn't made risen to the level of a national crisis by in the federal government. We have one of the most senior members of Congress, John Conyers, coming out of Detroit. That's his district. What has the reaction been so far? It is incomprehensible that this is not a major, major story.
It is a major story. It's a national story and an international story, but it's been made into a major story by grassroots organizations in cooperation with national and international groups, such as the National Nurses United, who were here in July to assist us in a mass demonstration. They declared a public health emergency in the city of Detroit due to the massive water shutoffs. Also, the politicians, many of whom are bought off by the powers that be, be they people who work in conjunction with the banks, the transnational corporations, and others to perpetuate this system. And they don't feel they're in a position to challenge the system. For example, the regionalization of the Detroit Water and Sewage Department. There was no reason whatsoever that the system should be regionalized. The DWSD provides water for people all over the region already, and even in other parts of the state. So the only reason why they want to regionalize the system is to, in fact, decrease the amount of power that the residents of the city of Detroit, who actually own the Detroit Water and Sewage Department. But the mayor was imposed from outside the city. He's from Livonia, Mike Duggan. He didn't even qualify for ballot status in the elections during 2013. He ran as a write-in candidate. There were humongous issues surrounding the veracity of the election. And the city council, by and large, are bought and sold by the banks and the corporations. So this is the reality of what's going on in the city of Detroit. It has nothing to do with collecting delinquent water bills. What they want to do, actually, is to privatize the system so they can make further profits. And at the same time, to drive African-Americans out of the city.
You happen to be involved in this case you're observing today. Tell us about this case and what is the relationship of this case to the situation in Detroit?
Well, right now I'm in St. Joseph's, Michigan, which is the seat of Berrien County. It's in the southwest region of the state of Michigan, right here on Lake Michigan. And Benton Harbor, which is a city adjacent to St. Joseph's, is a microcosm, represents a microcosm of what's going on in the city of Detroit. We have a majority African-American city that has been devastated through economic restructuring, where public assets have been taken away from the city and turned over to private corporations like Whirlpool and Harbor Shores Development. And Reverend Edward Pinckney from the Black Autonomy Network of Community Organizations has been a thorn in the side of the powers that be here in Berrien County. And for the second time, now they have him on trial for what I perceive to be very spurious charges. The first case was in 2007, where he was accused of mishandling some absentee ballots. This case involves a recall campaign against the mayor, James Hightower, who many people in the city of Benton Harbor do not like, and who signed the recall petitions. They were filed with the city clerk. And then, of course, Reverend Pinckney was charged with five felonies and six misdemeanors for supposedly forging or changing signatures on these recall petitions. So this trial, the trial began today, and I'm here observing the trial. Right now, the prosecution made its opening argument this morning. They presented four witnesses during this morning's proceedings as prosecution witnesses. But in listening to them, it's quite obvious that these witnesses are really not doing anything for the prosecution of this case. Many of them are activists who supported the recall campaign, who circulated signatures, and who have denied on the stand under oath that Reverend Pinckney had anything to do with changing any dates or any signatures on the petition. So it's quite striking that all four prosecution witnesses have not presented any incriminating evidence against Reverend Pinckney. It's an amazing situation.
What is the parallel with Benton Harbor, with Detroit?
Well, Detroit was a heavily industrialized city, and Benton Harbor, of course, with Whirlpool Corporation, and there was the shipping and the docks that were here. It employed a lot of people who came from the south to the state of Michigan to work. It used to be a fairly stable working class city, and it parallels Detroit in that regard. A lot of people, African-Americans and others, came into Detroit to work in the auto industry, the steel industry, and other service industries that were connected with the auto and steel industries. And with the restructuring of these industries, and when you restructure, of course, people lose jobs. They can't pay for cars and homes. They consequently lose those cars and homes. Either they move out of the city seeking greener pastures, or else they remain and try to survive under very underdeveloped and very distressed conditions. So the parallel is striking. You have huge foreclosure rates in Benton Harbor, just like in the city of Detroit. They took Jean-Claude Park, which was a public park, turned it over to Harbor Shores Development, built a Jack Nicklaus signature golf course where they hold now the PGA senior tournaments in 2012 as well as in 2014. They have lakefront properties right now. A similar situation is developing in Detroit where the state has taken over Belle Isle. The waterfront along Jefferson and downtown Detroit now has been essentially privatized. It's no longer under the sole management of the city of Detroit. So it's a very similar situation. Benton Harbor has had emergency managers. Detroit has had emergency managers. Even when you have so-called elected officials, they're not working on behalf of the people. They're working on behalf of the corporations and the banks. So the parallel between Benton Harbor, Detroit, Flint, and other cities, Inkster, Muskegon, is very striking.
Well, what you were saying by, you know, ticking off the names of all these cities that are predominantly African-American, they are under emergency management imposed by the governor. They are being assailed by corporations and private developers who are interested in aggregating the land and reassigning the use of the land for other purposes. They are literally taking over these towns and systematically emptying these towns of their current populations.
Right.
How should people begin to understand what is happening here in Flint, in Benton Harbor, Belle Isle, in Detroit, and other black cities and towns? Some people would say this is a kind of paranoid reaction, that there, maybe it is just, you know, a part of the natural evolution of things, that when things go down, people come in and a whole new order takes place, and it is a natural progression. But is there a racial aspect to this that you think?
Clearly. I mean, the impacted populations are African-Americans, working class, and poor. So the parallel is clearly there. And it is systematic. Anytime you change state law, the state constitution is abrogated, as in the bankruptcy proceedings in Detroit, where they said that they could tamper with the but the pensions of Detroiters, which were guaranteed by the state constitution. So this is the situation that we're facing right now in the city of Detroit and throughout the state of Michigan. So there's clearly a parallel, you know, in terms of racism, national oppression, and also all these changes that are taking place in the city of Detroit as well as in Benton Harbor.
How long will this trial against Reverend Pinckney last, you think? How long would it go for?
It could go on all this week. We're not sure. We just have to wait and see. They, of course, they have additional prosecution witnesses, and then, of course, the defense is going to call us witnesses as well. One interesting phenomena is that the courtroom was packed with supporters of Reverend Pinckney this morning, so much so that they had to have a overflow room with a closed-circuit television. That's how many people showed up from this area as well as Detroit and other areas of Michigan and as far as Chicago.
So, in a sense, Reverend Pinckney, all the way away from Detroit, about 3 hours' drive from Detroit, is
yes.
a symbol of the resistance movement to this phenomenon of the emptying, the systematic emptying of these black towns.
Yeah, yeah. This is what most people believe, that it's retaliation for his court monitoring, for his consistent electoral campaigns aimed at recalling and also running other African-American politicians for office. So it's clearly designed to have a deterring effect on the ability of people to resist, even within the framework of the local laws, the state constitution, which has provisions for recall elections. But all of that is being challenged by the legal system.
The United Nations sent observers to Detroit. Could you talk a bit about that?
Yeah, there were two United Nations special rapporteurs who visited not this weekend, but last weekend. And they issued a statement in the aftermath of their visit. They also met with Mike Duggan, saying that it was clearly human rights violations going on in Detroit, that people... No, I'll keep it. Yeah, it's obvious that, you know, there are human rights violations taking place. The mayor dismissed the findings and the statement of the United Nations Special Rapporteurs. So this goes to show they have no intentions of listening to reason. They have no intentions of acknowledging human rights. They are opposed to affordable water services. So therefore, the only real recourse that people have is... you know, organization and mass struggle. That's the only option that people have at this point. The local, state, and federal courts have consistently ruled against the interests of the majority of the people in Detroit and in other areas throughout the state of Michigan.
Well, I know you have a crushing demand on your time today, but I wanted to thank you so much for bringing
okay.
us up to speed, not only on Detroit, but the aftershock is now reaching all these other areas. And
exactly.
it is important to get a sense that despite the fact that this does not constitute a major national crisis, and that the government has not been responding appropriately, the leadership is not the established leadership is not responding appropriately, that does not mean that people are not fighting back. So thank you so much, Abayomi, and we'll be, of course, keeping in touch with you as the case progresses. And as you know,
okay.
today began in Detroit the summation in the bankruptcy
yes.
trial. So we'll be following that
yeah.
up as well. Thank you so much for being
okay,
with us.
Okay, thank you once again.
Good. Thank you. We'll take this break and come back and discuss big plans for your big city. And the big plan is you're not supposed to be there anymore.
As it's always done, carbon dust is a phase of everyone. Talking about the rich folks, the poor create the rich hoax, and only late breastfed fools believe it. So don't tell me about your success, nor your recipes for my happiness. Smoking bed, I never could digest those illusions you claim to have going.
You're listening to Lead Stories on PRN.FM. I'm Utrice Lead. On October the 14th, we had a special guest. All our guests are special, but this one was particularly rattling because of what his business is. And his business for many, many years is literally predicting how cities and countries will evolve. And he's a much sought-after person on an international level because countries want to be able to be ahead of the curve. His name is Joel Kotkin. He's the author of the provocative book, The New Class Conflict. And yesterday in the New York Daily News, he wrote an article that reinforced a major point of his book, and that is America's large urban centers are systematically being emptied of targeted populations and fast becoming strongholds for the wealthy. New York City, he says, is a prime example. Of course, when he was on the program, we discussed Detroit, and he talked about that. The importance of Detroit, and it is mind-boggling that we have, you know, just in recent developments, this is not counting what has happened before, that this most recent wave that would involve the massive displacement of up to 150,000 households, close to one-fifth of a population of a city, is about to be moved out. And this does not constitute a major story. And the reason, of course, is that these horrific policies usually are tested in communities of color first. And then they kind of decide whether these things, which of the nefarious plans are the most feasible or will be most easily done without resistance or so forth. How would the mechanisms work? And they test them on communities of color first. So while many may think, well, you know, Detroit, well, you know, Detroit is Detroit, and it's not going to happen here. What Kotkin said yesterday in the Daily News was, it very well will happen here in your big, wonderful metropolis. I want to read you this article, which pretty much extends the discussion that we had here on the program. And he writes it that it's titled RIP, Rest in Peace, New York City's Middle Class, Why Families Are Being Pushed Away from the City. He writes, Mayor de Blasio has his work cut out for him if he really wants to end New York's tale of two cities. Gotham has become the American capital of a national and even international trend toward greater income inequality and declining social mobility. There are things a new mayor can do to help, but the early signs aren't promising that he will be able to reverse 30 years of the hollowing out of the city's once vibrant middle class. As the cost of living has skyrocketed, while pay has stagnated except for those at the very top, New York has shifted from a place people go to make it to a place for those who already have made it, or whose families have. And once here, the rich are indeed getting richer, even as the rest of the city is barely holding on. Manhattan is now the most unequal county in America. It was 17th in 1980. With a Gini coefficient, which measures the disparity between the richest and poorest residents, higher than that of apartheid-era South Africa. Between 1990 and 2010, the city's 1% saw their median income shoot up from $452,415 to $716,625 in 2010 dollars, even as the bottom 60% hardly saw their incomes budge at all, according to a recent City University study. The trend precedes Michael Bloomberg, the billionaire mayor, who envisioned New York as a luxury city, and it won't be easy for de Blasio to reverse, especially as he rolls out pricey new public employee contracts and programs like universal pre-K. Percent of the city's income. Okay, am I being heard? In 2009, the 0.5% of New Yorkers who made $1 million or more accounted for 27% of the city's income, nearly three times their share nationally. I'm just trying to determine here whether we have a break. Are we okay? Okay. In 2009, the 0.5% of New Yorkers who made $1 million or more accounted for 27% of the city's income, nearly three times their share nationally, and an even higher share of its tax take. But while the smart set that attends President Obama's frequent Manhattan fundraisers has prospered, in no small part thanks to low-interest Federal Reserve policies that have helped big banks more than working people, just across the Harlem River, roughly one in three Bronx households lives in poverty, making it the nation's poorest urban county. Over the Bloomberg years, New York was a national leader in both luxury housing and homelessness, with a 73% jump in the number of homeless families here. Last January, an unprecedented 21,000 children were in the city's shelter system each night. This year, that number is rising. And as the city becomes more economically unequal, it's also become more racially segregated. Demographer Daniel Herr's census is now America's second most racially divided city, behind only Milwaukee. African American incomes in New York are barely half those of whites, as compared to nearly 70% in Phoenix and Houston. And New York City now has the nation's single most segregated public school system, according to a devastating report from the Civil Rights Project at UCLA. As a 2014 report put it, quote, in 2009, Black and Latino students in the state had the highest concentration in intensely segregated public schools, less than 10% white enrollment, the lowest exposure to white students, and the most uneven distribution with white students across schools, unquote. Nowhere are these divergences more obvious than in nouveau hipster and increasingly expensive Brooklyn. In my parents' native borough, the average income was actually dropped between 1999 and 2011, despite huge increases of wealth in areas closer to Manhattan. Roughly one in four Brooklynites, most of them Black or Hispanic, lives in poverty. Bloomberg's notion that if, quote, we can find a bunch of billionaires around the world to move here, that would be a godsend, unquote, with prosperity trickling down, hasn't panned out, at least for most New Yorkers. The billionaires came, bought, and flourished, but the same cannot be said for Gotham's middle and working classes. Using Bureau of Economic Analysis data, analyst Aaron Wren estimates that the city's per capita GDP has grown a bare 2.3% since 2010, below the mediocre 3.8% national rate, and behind such traditional hard luck cases as Buffalo, Cleveland, and Baltimore. The percentage of New Yorkers living in poverty has actually gone up by 1.1% since 2010, while household income has been flat. Rather than forge a more upwardly mobile society, New York epitomizes what Citigroup researchers have labeled a plutonomy, that is, an economy and society driven largely by the investment behavior and spending of the uber-rich. This creates great demand for low-end service workers, dog walkers, baristas, and waiters, but not much for New York's middle or aspiring middle class. Adjusting for the cost of living here, the average paycheck in New York is one of the lowest in any major metropolitan area. Put otherwise, New Yorkers pay a huge premium to live in the five boroughs, one that repels middle-class individuals and families who aren't compelled to be here. The exodus of the middle class has been ongoing for 30 years, with New York, by one measure, now having the second lowest share of middle-income neighborhoods of America's 100 largest cities. As the middle class has waned, even exemplars of the celebrated creative class, musicians, artists, writers, find the going increasingly rough and unrewarding. Laments rock icon Patti Smith, quote, "New York has closed itself off to the young and the struggling. New York City has taken away from you," unquote. This is the dynamic New Yorkers elected de Blasio to fix. And he's right, the reality of rising inequality and, more important, diminishing opportunity must be confronted. Critically, and here de Blasio has better instincts than his predecessor, more emphasis needs to be placed on the outer boroughs. Even if Manhattan remains the prototypical luxury city, the rest of New York can be reinvented as a generator of middle-class jobs and opportunities. One approach that's paid in dividends for workers in cities such as Houston, Dallas-Fort Worth, Nashville, and Pittsburgh is to concentrate on diversified economic growth. Certainly, some middle-class jobs could be created by boosting such things as the port and logistics, resuscitating industries such as food processing and specialized household goods, and rolling out policies that encourage rather than over-regulate smaller firms in the business and service industry. But de Blasio's press to bring in more tax revenue to pay for ambitious new programs, more generous social services, and new contracts for city workers have the perverse effect of doubling down on Bloomberg's bet on the wealthy. His ambitious ramping up of green energy policy could be the straw that breaks the back of what remains of the logistics and manufacturing industries in New York, something that has already occurred in California. And his kowtowing to the teachers' union and attempted assaults on charter schools threaten to further undermine the effectiveness of public education, something vital to middle and working class residents. In fact, the effect of de Blasio's policies may turn out to be more neo-Victorian than progressive. Rather than new homeowners, the city may see a greater concentration of people dependent on government largesse. The poor door phenomena, with a few lucky members of the lower class winning subsidized units in buildings for the rich, but with separate entrances and no access to luxury amenities, recreates not social democracy, but the Victorian upstairs-downstairs society. The critical point is this: New York is losing its role as a place of opportunity, And the de Blasio toolbox is unlikely to put back the ladders that have been pulled up. A great city does not only serve the rich, transforming others into their servants or recipients of noblesse oblige. New York needs to be, as René Descartes described Gotham's founding city, 17th century Amsterdam, quote, an inventory of the possible, unquote. That must hold true for most New Yorkers, not just for the very rich. Well, there may be things in there that you might disagree with, but overwhelmingly, the point is made that New York City isn't what people think it is. That it is this great place of opportunity. He discusses the fact that one in three people in the Bronx is living at or below the poverty rate. That New York has the most segregated schools in the nation. He's talking about the stagnation of income and the correlation of race in all of this. He's saying, in effect, that there is a systematic approach to city planning and policy making. And the systematic approach here, which has been in place and has been ongoing for 30 years, as he pegs it, 30 years, is having the net effect of creating two cities right now in the city of New York. One for the rich and one for the rest of us. That's what he's saying. Now, this particular movement 30 years ago, you can link directly to the urban renewal programs of the 60s, where cities were encouraged to expand and to be more democratic. The backlash has been this incipient movement, 30 years in the making, to reverse just about everything that was attempted and let alone accomplished in the era of the 60s, where we saw a tiny little bit of elastic put into city policy. To the point where we are seeing cities basically reorganizing themselves with respect not only to this class division, but respect to the natural, quote unquote, I'm using the word facetiously, the natural racial order. The thing that Kotkin points out is, without saying it explicitly, is that he is suggesting that the methods used against people of color were so effective that they now have caught up to the people that we described as middle class. And we never really did have a black or Latino middle class in New York City. So what he's saying is white working class and middle class people have now become the poor. They have now become the second and third tier people in their own city because the application of these policies has had a broader than intended effect. And when he was on the program, if you remember, he talked about the emergence now of this combination of the wealthy, who are now directly involved in policy making and in politics, running things, running the city, and the rise of the young oligarchs, the technocrats, the people who have just obscene amounts of wealth and are using their extremely well-positioned roles in society to flex their political muscle and to impose the ideological will. So we have a combination of two sets of people who really aren't about to create that democratic vision that cities like New York and lately Detroit espouse. So this is something to think about. I am just stunned, and we all should be, that the story of the city of Detroit, what is going on there, and what is about to happen in other predominantly African-American cities in Michigan. But I'm just stunned that these issues have not constituted a crisis for leadership groups like the Congressional Black Caucus and not just the black people, but this is a human story. This is the point. When these things are perceived as being affecting particular racial groups, and we see a retreat by the progressive community, the progressive white community, that says, well, you know, it's their problem. You know, they'll have to find a way to solve it. We're not involved. So we don't have a vested interest in advocacy here. So we could be absent from this whole story. And then we see that with silence, that is condoning these things, they take on a kind of infection. They spread. They contaminate all other cities. And soon it is no longer a black problem or a Latino problem. It is no longer a poor problem or working class problem. It now becomes a national problem. But when it was time for people to step forward and to confront these things and to publicly decry them and to demand a better response from the federal government and the state government and the local government, when it was time for them to literally advocate justice and they were silent, then they basically consign the future communities to the same kind of treatment. This is a huge story. Anytime one-fifth, this is now on top of the foreclosures already in place that have been devastating. When a city, the remaining population of the city, one-fifth, fully one-fifth of them will now have to deal with being evicted from their homes, having their properties taken from them. And there is no outcry, and it is clearly targeted at African American and Latino communities. Absolutely, no question about it. And there is no outcry. I don't know what to say. I really don't know what to say. The only thing that we can do is support those people who are fighting. And there are people who are fighting, and that's the very weak glimmer of hope, but it is a glimmer of hope. We have to support these people, and we really have to attack the system that allows this kind of blatant racism and inhumanity to occur. And all the more reason I keep asking, what is your point in voting? People in New York should say, I am in New York, but no system that does this to people in Detroit would I support. I can't support a system that does that to people in Detroit. I can't be part of a system that does that to people in Belle Isle or Benton Harbor or in Flint. I refuse to be part of that. And the vast majority of these people in a position to do something are Democrats. Just want to remind you about that. We've come to the end of our program today. I hope this causes you to rethink or to begin to think about Detroit and its significance and what it is that could be done within your own capacity to help. We really do need to understand this as a major national crisis. This is a tragedy of unimaginable proportions happening right before our eyes. Stay tuned. Coming up next is Wake Up Call with Richard Martin. Reach me. Let me know how these programs are resonating with you. LeadStories@gmail.com and on Facebook, Lead Stories with Eutrice Lead. I just want to thank everyone. My visit was just so incredible. I could hardly get over it. It was just so incredible. extremely emotional and extremely just beautiful, just a wonderful, wonderful, wonderful experience. I thank you all for your sentiments and for affording me the opportunity to meet with you personally. Hopefully we can meet again soon. Thank you. Stay tuned.
Talking about the rich folks, the poor create the rich hopes.